Shaman's Den, all the way from Woodstock, New York, tonight is the poet Normal.
I guess I talk. My name's Normal, which is not a benchmark for what anybody should ever try to be in life. But that's the name I've had for 40 years. So that's the name you're going to get. Last night I was thinking about coming on. I woke up at 5 in the morning. So I want to wail a poem without music prep first. And you guys are getting the first thing. The ink's still running down my left hand here. I woke up at 5 and I wrote this poem. And this is for you, baby. It's called I'll Wear This Hat to San Francisco. I come dressed as a tourist. Am I not a tourist? Is there any entity anywhere that is not a tourist? White man is tourist to the Indian. Indian is tourist to the white. The rock is only visiting the earth. The earth is really only passing through. The sea has borrowed from the sky. The sky is on loan from infinity. The hepatic liver far outlasts the eternal lover. My own pancreas has outlived 3 lovers, which probably means you are hearing this poem from a bona fide zombie. The minute passes. The work card might as well be a library card. The clock runs out. The cell is for sale. All sales are for your cells. None are final. The big sale is your soul. Your soul is dressed as a tourist, ready for the big buy. The bus says, get on, 'cause we're leaving. The bus is filled with old souls staring out the window. The scene passes. The bus rolls on. The same scenes roll by again and again. The past is seen again and again. And all that was never seen is doomed to be seen when you wish you were blind. The tourist is invisible. A checkmate let past by God. The tourist passes, wearing an annoying striped shirt. I come dressed as a tourist. My shirts are old, so is my hat. But I wear them well. Hot off the press.
Mm-hmm.
poetry and music. We can do that. We can get into all kinds of stuff. I'm ready to boogie. You guys are going to get some stuff from a chappie I did off for with Rain Dog. Well, it's from Rain Dog's Lum Express called Blood on the Floor. That's an old chappie, an old collection. You're going to get a new collection. I just got the galleys, and you're going to get stuff that's never been in any collection. And you may get some stuff that just came out between my cranium plantation, too. We don't know where it's going to go. Can you hear? Am I close to the microphone to jam? Okay. Okay, musicians. 1, 2, 3. This one is written to a friend of mine, and it's a true story about a guy who spent his life trying to get ready to live, going to all kinds of therapy, going to all kinds of stuff, just getting ready to live. And I just kept saying, Sal, live already, live already, live already. And finally what happened with Sal is Sal stuck a needle in his arm at the wrong time and picked up a case of AIDS. And his last 6 months of life, Sal learned how to live. He gave up all the premonitions of how he was supposed to live, and he just did live. He took a credit card and he went to Italy, went back to his roots, and the last thing he saw was the sun setting on the Mediterranean. And the Sal, this one's for you. Dead man's underwear. I am wearing the underwear of a dead man. A dear friend who died from AIDS. In the end, his underwear was the only thing he had left to give me. So I wear them gratefully. They are warm and cozy, and certainly of better quality than any underwear I have ever worn before. I told this to a guy at work. He said, watch it! You'll catch the disease right out of his underwear! And then he did not talk to me again. Ever. We're going to find out how Normal started getting his name Normal. It wasn't from a birthing accident or anything like that. Mother wanted to name him Celery, but that was a little too vegged out. Then she wanted to name him Petunia, but the garden was still going victory. So she decided to find another thing to do. And she raised a son that was going to go into the war. But before the war, he had to go into the draft board. And this is the story of Normal in the draft board. True story. True story. Green Buses, Newark, New Jersey, 1963. I stood in the draft board. I was 98 pounds, pigtailed, silverfish earringed, gold lame coat. Then I was naked. All those crew cut guys yelling, "Sweetheart! Hey, sweetheart! How do people like him survive?" But I was naked, and my dick was average. Your typical run-of-the-mill medium-sized Jewish dick. The sergeant sat looking at my records, his forehead pushed up like a washboard road. "What do you do for a living?"
"I'm a jazz poet."
"Where do you work?"
"Greenwich Village,
Section 10. Get the hell out of here!" I was the second person rejected from military service that day. The first person rejected down at Section 10 was my old grade school buddy, Conrad Nubler, who I wasn't supposed to hang out with back then because I was Jewish and his family was from Germany. But he was my first friend, and I showed him my circumcision, and he taught me how to eat bacon. Later, he wrote a thesis on what he called Nazi Americanism, and was promptly booted from school. Connie was dressed in a Sandra Dee skirt and an Annette Funicello hairdo and a Joan Crawford dinner jacket. And I had pigtails, gold lame coat, silverfish earrings. We sat there, the two of us, down in Section 10. The first two rejectees that year in the state, laughing and talking up the old times, while the boys howled and hooted, "Sweetheart! Sweetheart!" On the way to the green buses. throwing tears at the stones. The last thing she remembered were the Jewish girls being led barefoot through the snow and into the gas chambers, singing HaTikvah. These days, she knows the Arab's passion as she watches silently their eyes peering over the timeless devil hair of barbed wire. These days, it is her ritual to walk the long robes of steel and pass roses across the miles of tangled differences. And it is her custom to consider this piece of space flesh called Earth in terms of iron and flowers, in terms of songs that cannot be heard, in terms of the silences that are too loud for anyone to hear. Butchers, everything. The Arabs butcher the Jews. The Jews butcher. Sister in America butchers the hours with soap opera. All systems butcher passion. It is all much of the same. The differences in stone that neither time nor technology can reverse. She bows before the wailing wall. She speaks to the old ghosts as if they are the unborn children of tomorrow. These days, to the passing observer, it would appear she is just another old woman in black with nothing more to do but throw tears at the stones. One of the things I do in my life is try to get out of my life by getting into other people's lives. And one of the ways that I can do it is that and sometimes I'm a nurse to the dying, and sometimes I'm a nurse to the living. Sometimes I'm a nurse to the reborning. And I love the old people. And this is a story about an old lady I took care of years ago. It's called Diva in Diapers. Not much left of her, just an old lady in an empty shell, sitting in a geriatric chair. Day after night after day, drawing dumb squares with a crayon, moving her thumbs from one corner of the ripped bath blanket to the other, and back across to where she first started, involved in her work. She's proving the world is flat, that life is just shit. Milk streaks like faded war paint on the corners of her mouth. At least 10 times a day I pass by her. She grabs from my balls. I dance out of the way. "What's your name?" she says. "George," I tell her. "Lily Lynette," I tell her. "What's your name?" she says. I veer out of her way. I'm busy. It's always the same. I need to change the IV tubing. I need to give out milk and mag. I need to do mortuary care. They are dying all over the place, and I'm being dragged up into the next generation. I gotta clean bed sores, wring out pissed up sheets, I hold a hand or two if I'm in the mood. A nurse's work is never done. "What's your name?" "I don't have one." "What's your name?" "Look it up in the phone book." The elders here come and go. A parade of wrinkles. The dentures
chatter at me like angry castanets. I become bent. My spine is tired and hot. My hair thins to the brush. The coal bell crackles like electric crickets. A death in room 207. Someone watching the devil. A sneer in the face of the clock on the wall. A screamer in 212. The next generation is calling. She cackles, "What's your name?" The old lady's eyes are vacant. My balls shrink. The night light hung. The night light off. The bed sag. The poor floorboards yawn. The building's foundation begins to crumble. The hospital is in a lousier turned lousy neighborhood in a sinking city of quick passing population. The young ones are worse than the old. The angels here are howling. In a Johnny Jumper gown. What's your name? Day after night after day. In her empty shell. The milk dried and crusty upon her lips. Diva in diapers. Diva in diapers. She looks up to the stars. She sees a heaven full of testicles, all glittering, smiling. To make a wish, to give a name. What's your name? What's your
blood on the floor.
Don't slip. There is blood on the floor. Blood of apathy. Blood of the dispassionate, the ignoring, blood of those numbed by dumb life, blood of those who pretend it never happens, the cheerfully humble who go about it all smiling. Blood of the corpses that have not yet died. the baby 5 years into life, not yet born. The ancient one, bereft of wisdom, not yet lived. Blood of the holy filthy. Blood on the Godhead. Blood of the rich in their diamond fish bowls. The paparazzi in their glory. The machines in their monopoly. The innocent in their strangulation. The earth in her silence. Don't slip. The anomalies are pure. The sky is red. The raindrops are loaded with the eyes of children. Don't slip. There is blood on the This, I just got the galleys from Lubbock Press. My buddy Rain Dog sent it out. And, so I'm just kind of like looking at stuff that it's been a couple of years. I've been sending him stuff. He's been putting it down. You know, I kind of drop in and out of the poetry scene because it's so fucking incestuous. You know, so every so often I come out with a little something. And, you know, this is one of the things we're doing is but I guess I can plug my CD that I put together with a bunch of musicians, and my wife Charlotte over there did the collage at the beginning. I don't know if you can catch the collage. Yeah, and this book came out kind of after 9/11, and being on the East Coast, there was a tremendous effect that it had. And yeah, the human spirit being able to rise through the ashes and fight for the right to live and to survive as a species and as a race. And so we put this thing out, the collage. We're kind of doing it as a companion piece, American Child, which is not... This is what you see before you see a book, is the galleys, you know, and there's a lot of imperfections in it. And we're going to put it together with Charlotte's art and the music of four or five different musicians wailing with it. So right now, we're just wailing our own music. I'm going to wail a few pieces from the new collection and see where this baby goes. Yeah, some of it has nothing to do with 9/11. Some of it's old, you know. Maybe I gave it the wrong buildup. This one is called Awakening. 1967. The summer of love, I broke up with my wife. And everyone else I knew
breaking up with their wives and their husbands and losing their jobs and going to the whack house and going to the barrel house and running off to India and Belize and Israel and everybody I knew got thrown in jail. The summer of love saw all the Brill Cream boys I used to play chess with go to Vietnam and go to My Lai and come home in body bags and throw bricks through the windows of the 7-Eleven and take hideous LSD trips and have satoris in front of the Tasmanian devil pit at the San Diego Zoo. Behind the masks, beneath the blood coats, the alienation was the same. The summer of love passed quick as if it had never came. Too many priests, not enough savages, and all the flowers wilted. In all the children age, and the cops retired, then we all retire. And as the snails shit on the rocket ship, and the Scoville horse rode off on the balls of a saint, the street signs bowed their tired heads.
It's funny, now I'm like somewhere between puberty and death, you know, and I was just talking to Charlotte, you know, now I have a sense of my own mortality, and I'm thinking about God, so, you know, and I got fear. When I was younger, I said, fuck God, and I had no fear, so what is that about? You know, I guess, you know, you get caught up in the end game and it's really the beginning game. And I think it was T.S. Eliot said, you know, after the final journey, you all wind up at the same spot anyhow, to paraphrase. You know, my grandmother said, make sure to wash your hands when you wake up in the morning, but you don't know where they've been during the night. And when you go to sleep at night, make sure not to wear your socks or underwear because there's places in your body that need to breathe. I'm gonna stick with the Jewish theme here while we're talking about my grandmother. She was a great woman, yeah. And this is a true story. It happened in North Beach, man. I was living on the street. We were walking around. We hadn't eaten in days and days and days. I'm gonna do my Jackie Mason on this one. I'm gonna do a Jackie Mason interpretation. It's gonna be bad, real bad. True story called Two Jews in a Baptism Tank. A madman passed me on the street. You are near God, he shouted in my face. Piss off, I said.
Later, a Presley-suited fellow named Brother Elmer, along with his gang of chatting Christos, picked up Maxie and me off a corner of Broadway and Grant and brought us back by limo to their congregation in a place a cow pasture used to be. They fed us meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and peas. And for that, we let them baptize us to so long ago well-circumcised Jews. That night, my great Uncle Nooney returned to me in a dream from drunken hell. He elbowed his way past a lovely lady dressed in white. "What do you want with me, great drunken Uncle Nooney?" I said. And he said, "Too short this life, kid." And then he said, "When you got just 5 minutes to do it in, sometimes it feels better to joik off than to pray." And then Uncle Nooney chased after the lovely lady in white right out of the dream. And I woke up and never ate meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and peas again. Never. I had to do a religious joke. I mean, this poem, you know. I was, you know, like building towards this thing. You want to ask me some crazy questions, man? You know, like, you know, goof on some crazy shit or something? You want to do that? See. Oh, man. Okay. About the, you know, as you go older and you slide down the razor blade of life into the setting sun, you know, your sense of mortality comes back to plague you. And you realize it's all, you know, it's the end game is the beginning game. I'll say in this poem, you know, I feel, you know, weird talking like a folk singer, you know, like trying to, you know, tune his guitar between poems. So I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to, I have a little saying before this poem. It's by Diane Arbus. And she said, "Identity is what you have left when everything else you have is taken away." Song to the earthworms. Through life, occasionally touched, sometimes with a sword, other times by a definition. In the end, you go it alone. Kamunu this. I know this. Bozo the clown knows this. I've looked in the eyes of children and idiots, those who have cakewalked barefoot with the geese, and those who have worn wax wings in an attempt to fly with the angels. Some laugh, some wail, some looked away. Today I join the chorus of bacteria and earthworms
today I retreat from a world dumb by the disease of words and promises. My portfolio of ancestors has dissolved into phosphorescent pools filled with disillusioned Darwinian fish. The rocks bare their hungry teeth in a sodomy of wrinkles brought on by the years, gulped by sensation and saliva. Today, I go it alone. God and gentlemen, ladies of the jury, I call to you. Give me the mechanics of your loving gesture. Blow your horn from beauty's September tree. My shadow has shed its technology. My shirt is torn open. Behind my eyelids, gold dogs are dragged and strange creatures are uncorked.
American enough.
I am American enough to chase an irrepressible dream 8 times round a stricken television set, like an optimist lunatic loose in Hades, a fool's cheerleader in a Bermuda Triangle parade.
Soon later, I was brought up before machine judge. God, I cried, I have no plea but my own innocence. I am American enough to say, had Ho Chi Minh been American white, they would find a place for him on Mount Rushmore. American enough to say that if Hitler were American, he would have been shot by Al Capone. American enough to say a jury of hungry hyenas, busier than shit flies and on their way to a Yankee game, passed long enough to chew on the fragile flower of that cryptic reality I call my own.
The galley door closed, and I was proclaimed guilty and sentenced to row a boat across the great American swamp forever, where the ghosts of giants sleepwalk through the thousand-eyed night of corporate eternity. And Walt Whitman plays Mahjong with a mad horseman in the moon.
I wrote this piece while the Twin Towers were burning. And I live in the country. I'm surrounded by beauty. And on a September morning, the smoke was coming through CNN, right through the television screen. And the worst horrible of nightmares were happening to people, and the human spirit was called, and I don't even remember writing this. I just remember looking up, and this piece is called An Hour Before. September 11th 2001, early morning, not a cloud in the sky, squirrels hop from branch to branch, twigs snap, frost crawls just above the roots. Billie Holiday said, blues is kind of a mixed up thing. You just gotta feel it. Autumn approaches. Come to the Weeping Mountain. Come to the Weeping Mountain and let us spend the night, for all the beaten children, for all the screaming January, for all the sneering lullabies you never sang to me. Come to the Weeping Mountain
and let us spend the night. And let us have a vision of heaven. And let us have a vision of submission. And let us sing a chorus of hydrogen blues for all the essentials of life's dumb questions you never sang to me. Where the doves leave bitter calling cards, and the obliteration transforms the eyes of everyone's interior, and the monologue is sponsored by Buddhist drums, where the contours of redemption's angel is visible, and the straitjackets hold up our trousers, and the desolation is complete. Come to the creek at the foot of the weeping holy mountain, and let us spend the night singing songs you never sang to me. You a poem, baby. Okay. This one is to Charlotte, my muse. A blue smoke to the tropics. I am smoke with you. Fiery sky crackling. Heaven smoke, blue smoke, blue smoke wind in the inciting of the gases. You have me, you straddle me, ride me over the promenade, across the prairie, in between the big tits of the sweating valleys. You call me trigger, call me silver, call me rin-tin-tinny. Gallop me up and down the streets, scream to me, the moon in your eyes sings me a song, bluer than violets, buggier than a wet lawn. Your eyes, your spittle,
sprays me. I am a flower bed. You are the mounting rain of spring. Clouds explode. Mist runs between us, all over us. Oh, me, your dependable, average, built, middle-aged, Jewish, munchkin, maniacal, huffer, puffer, in the tongue, lick, blue, smoke, moment, instantaneously becomes, yes, erotically, magically transforms me into your smartly, swarthy, sexy, Latin, dashing, debonair lover, Valentino, Don Juan, Romeo, Johnny Depp, cool young, water fountain, studding, blue smoke, it's over the edge with you and me, gyrating better than happy hula hoops. Me and you, I am your water horse, thunderstruck. We are whales breaching, oh so gloriously, in the rainbow sea, followed by a tidal wave of ambergris and the long sui cool blue smoke wind blowing all the way to the tropics.
All right, don't go anywhere, anybody. You're going to watch us get set up for Frank to talk with Normal. A, B, C, D, L, M, A, E, A, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, M, E, U, M, E, M, U, L, M, N, O, A, B, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, must, M, U, S, music, A, music, A, B, C, D, E, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, A, E, H, H, when, A, E, I, while, you're, while we set up, music while we set up. As our band walks out the door.
Leon, football, marching, football, yeah, band.
Kariya kangi banna kahanga je tu kata se ga
Background. Yes. Yeah. Sounds so good. Sounds so good.
You guys are great, man. Yeah. It's beautiful. You're incredible.
He's not talking into the he is talking into the mic. Yeah. Can you hear now? You can't hear? He can't hear. What's it is turned on, I see. Yeah, it is. Okay. Can you hear me? He can hear me now. See if you talk now.
Can you hear me? Frank, can you hear me?
not as well.
No.
Try talking louder.
If I talk louder, yeah. Our brains are getting blown up here. Holy cow, we got to get parachutes for our cerebral cortexes.
The V. That is the V volume that works for you. That's the volume that works for Frank. Loud. Okay, so you okay? You're okay? We'll see. All right. How? L. O. How long have you been doing what you do?
Philosophically? Emotionally? you talk about whale and poetry?
On you. You are one of T.H. those kinds of who M.A. make me work hard. You're one of those who make him work hard.
Cool. what did Allen Ginsberg say? Something about putting gave shoulder to the wheel or something like that? Yeah, put our shoulders, poetic shoulders, to the wheel. Thank you. So what's the direct question is, how long have I been whaling poetry or writing?
How long have you been doing what you do?
Oh man, I got so many hats. My next lifetime, I gotta have. I want to come back with a hat rack, not a human being. I gotta wear so many. In terms of poetry, I've been writing since I've been a little kid. You know, I felt totally. Can you hear me, Frank?
He can't hear him that well.
You can't hear me?
No. Oh, let me just put the plug in. Talk now and see.
Can you hear me now, Frank?
Another tech moment. What about if he just wore that mic around his neck? He can probably hear me okay. We're thinking about giving Normal the mic around his neck because you can hear me okay now. Yeah. I. Even W E N went to the ear doctor. Yeah, yeah. Usually that works to improve the hearing, but we're going through a bad hearing period.
Charlotte knows how to take earwax out of ears. She's good. She loves doing it. I'll put her on loan to clear her earwax out of the ear. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay.
All right, we'll see if that works.
Is that how you got your name, Mikey?
You. You will. You would. Think. I. Can. Hear. A, B, E, A, beat, poet. You would think you'd be able to hear a beat poet. They're supposed to be loud. Yeah. Okay, try talking, see if he can hear you now.
So the question is,
the question
how
is,
long have you been doing what you're doing? You started saying about your many hats.
Oh, yeah. I do so many different things, you know, but...
Like what?
Like try to keep a household together, try to keep a dog happy, trying to keep myself happy, trying to make a living, trying to do some service.
That is what I am getting at. That's what you're getting at. Why? How? How can you keep doing all of those things? How can you keep doing all of those things and not get be burnt out?
I have been burnt out. As I said, one of the things I've been... Can you hear me, Frank?
Yes.
One of the things I've been is a nurse. I used to work in a detox unit and be taking care of like 20 patients at once. And I come back, totally fried would be the word. And it's hard to write poetry when you're fried out. But it's also the salvation that keeps... me going, the joy. And sometimes now I wake up, I have so much paperwork, and I wake up at 4 in the morning and I don't get to sleep until 10. And I'll wake up recently, like I wake up maybe at 3, 4 in the morning, and I'll write an hour or so, and I don't even look back at it. I've got several months of paper, of stuff that I haven't even looked back at. I haven't sent a poem out, you know, to be published or rejected, as okay, the good guys, bad guys. I haven't sent a poem out in 6 months because I just don't have the time to rewrite it and look at it. It is, it's a horrible, you know, it's a strong balancing act. And I was kidding, you know, my next lifetime, I want to be born a hat rack, not a human being, so I wear so many different hats. I'd like to divide myself into all these little normal clones. Lots of different clones, and send one clone out to go to work, one clone out to make love, one clone out to write poetry, one clone out to feed, walk the dog, and at the end of the day, have them all come back to central computer.
Or TR, tribe, tribal. Yeah, Frank, actually, he has a poem where he talks about that. It's if you're a tribe, and then you can do all that stuff at once. Somebody's, like, earning the money. Somebody's writing the poetry. Somebody's keeping house.
Yeah. That's the way it was in the old days, yeah. That's right. You had your shamans, right? You had your shamans. You had your agrarians, the hunters. The bead makers.
But all a as one being, all as one being.
A tribe unto one. Yeah, a tribe unto one is really what you call the evolved spirit. Maybe that's what we work for in life, and few people get there. I know I am not there yet. Maybe that's...
He said few people. Oh, you heard that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, you're hearing it.
A tribe of one.
Yeah.
To be able to do those things.
I get people who think they should be O N only doing
there, a art, only meaning that that's the only thing they should do, or that they shouldn't have other people involved in it, that that's the only thing they should do, not a D A day job. Right. He gets people that think that what what they really should be doing is just have all their time to do their art, and to have a day job is somehow less, somehow not right.
When I was a kid, I was there. I mean, I did that as a kid. I started wailing poetry in the village back in 63, 64 in Greenwich Village, and passed the basket, and I just wrote, and I, you know, lived in abandoned buildings and everything. And I have tremendous respect for people who can do that. I couldn't. I just couldn't. And I don't romanticize penury. And on the other hand, finding the balance in life, I also find just to write is a great thing to give people. It's a beautiful thing to give people. But there's also a tremendous selfishness about it. When you do nothing but say, hey, I'm the center of the universe, I'm going to create, and the rest of the world can go to hell. You know, so there's two pieces of that. And I understand both pieces.
How did you F I figure that out?
Starved for a lot of years. Starved for a lot of years.
That will do it.
That'll do it. Yeah. I have no notions, false notions, but I have tremendous respect for people who can do that and are able to do that, you know. And I also know a lot. I don't want to sit in judgment. I feel like sometimes I'm sitting in judgment, but I guess because I've seen both sides of it. May I use an example with my lover, with Charlotte? Will you allow me to use you as an example? When she was a kid, okay, she grew up in a very poor, you know, in the next thing from a ghetto, and she loves artwork. She loves doing artwork. Can you hear me, Frank?
Yes.
She loves doing artwork. And like a lot of people, you know, she got to the crossroads of, should I dedicate my life to trying to create the art or trying to make a living, or what can I do? So she decided that she would teach art. And that would be, you know, that would be her art, would be to bring art to children and to do that as a part of her creative thing. Now she's retired and she has spent a life doing that, and that's her way of doing it. And I think we could make our own rules on this thing. I don't think it's a black or white situation. You know, and maybe in her old age, her and me are going to write some beautiful stuff together. But, you know, you're doing art right now. I mean, it's everyone, they're doing art right now. They just did some beautiful art. Frank's doing
A
art now.
X. Exactly. That is what I U S usually T tell people. Don't D divide life from art. That's what he usually tells people.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
Don't think you D E S deserve to get P E P A paid for your art. Always be S-U-R-P-R, surprised when you do get paid for your art.
That's right. Art and spirit. Life and spirit. When you diminish the spirit from life, what you got is not a life. What you got is a mess. And if you're trying to create, to make money at it, watch out. Step aside.
That is a S U R sure way to get burnt out. No, good, get B I bitter. That's a sure way to get bitter.
Yeah. Yeah. How many people become disillusioned because they are not Michelangelo? You know, they're not the great person they think. They're not going to be immortal. And they become disillusioned. Winos laying in a back room someplace with dirty underwear, cursing at the world and embittered because the world has not come to accept their brilliance.
Yes. I N S instead of J, just doing what they want, instead of just doing what you want to do in art, just do what you want to do in art, or what a r t or what art wants you to do.
There's a whole trap in underground poetry, a whole trap where people get into, I'm going to write to get published because this is in vogue.
Yes.
And what you've done is you've left your soul in the back seat in order to get a name. I think every poet should about every 3 years change their fucking names and send out under pseudonyms and different names to the same publishers and see how it goes. You know, and just do it for the love of doing it. Instead of my name is da 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 da.
They. S. E. E. They see it as a S. T. Stepping stone to thing some where else in to M A mainstream. If you want mainstream, T O two. No, if you want mainstream, G go D directly to mainstream. That is M much easier.
The New Yorker each year, each month, how many people go crazy because only one person gets accepted in the New Yorker? If you're creating, you got to figure out why you're creating. People have said, why do you create? You know why? because it's a better option to going crazy. That's why.
Yes. It is a addiction.
That's, I have to agree and not agree at the same time. It's surely it's kept me from throwing myself off a bridge on a number of occasions. But there are other times that I've had to ask myself, you know, is it really healthy? Because what are my motives? And you know, I think if you live long enough, and you write and you create long enough, you're going to find yourself going, I'm speaking for myself, going through all the changes. And I think more I get my ego involved in it, the more bullshit comes out. You know, the less I'm involved with... I have this theory about antennas being up in the air. I'm looking at you and I'm thinking of something I've lived all my life. Thinking that if your antennas are up, your poetical antennas, and you're feeling the pure of spirit in that, that you're going to be the conduit for the poem that's going to come through, and it isn't going to have a whole lot of thinking involved.
Yes.
And that's where the true poem's going to come from.
I don't think I see. Create. CR. Create. I think I see channel. My job is to get O out of the way.
Yeah. Stop tripping over your own underwear. Yeah, I can't. You get it. Yeah, I get it. I agree. Get out of your own way. You know when I write my worst poetry? When I sit down to write a poem.
Yes. B. E. Because you think you know what it should be.
Sometimes the vision comes after the poem, not before the poem. It's a tailgate vision that a power greater than yourself has been performing for you while you've been running after, you know, trying to put the tail of the snake up your own butt. And, yeah, so I think the vision... I mean, we're talking about visionary poetry.
Does he always T-A talk like this? Yes. Yes.
It's a constant source of embarrassment for her. It's a constant source of embarrassment at times. You can't take yourself seriously. That's the most important thing.
And you, Jay, you just S. A, say, oh, he is a poet. He says, you just say, oh, he's a poet.
It's an easy out. It's better than say you're going to get me my next dose of Thorazine. Unfortunately, most people don't understand that. You know, he's a poet. You know, oh, yeah, right. I have wings and can fly too.
How? What? K. Kind. Of. R. E. A. C. Reaction. Do you run into? You're asking Charlotte? He's talking about the circumstance under which you would say, oh, he's a poet. When he says things like that, Frank is asking, what kind of reaction do you run into from people?
I wonder what their reaction is, because I'm just happy with him. The way he is. All of them.
How did you L you luck out? You're asking normal, how did he luck out to get Charlotte?
Well, there's a story behind that. I don't know how much airtime we got. There is a story about how we met. Do you want to hear?
We want to hear. Yes.
Hear? Go for it. You tell it.
Well, I was married to an anal retentive for 19 years. And so I was ready to spread my wings. And I went to Omega Institute to spend part of the summer in a work-study program. And Norm was reading his junk mail and came across the Omega catalog. And he decided to come to Omega for the same time that I was coming to Omega. And we were both on staff. And we met because I was about to run the New York City Marathon for the fifth time. And I was running and needed to have massages, which I had in the city all the time, but I wasn't having them up there. So we did a massage exchange and fell in love the first night.
Actually, I fell asleep the first massage.
He did fall asleep after he was massaging me and fell asleep on my back, holding my back, because he had just eaten a big lunch. And then I lived in his tent for the rest of the summer. And he lived in Vermont and I lived in New York City, and we had to figure out how we were going to be together. And we just made it work for 15 years without living together. And now we're doing that.
This is the first time in 15 years that we're actually living together. Yeah.
How is it so far?
So far, great, but I have my frying pan ready.
It's got my name on it. It's got my name on it. She runs a sturdy ship. I've been bachelor all my life, you know, 60 years living by myself. So it's new for me to live with, you know, my dog. It's new for me to live with a person. And it's a beautiful thing, because it's kind of like having a honeymoon now. I mean, we're out on the West Coast. I lived here for 10 years, and this is the first time in 25 years I've come back to the West Coast, and it's like coming back for my honeymoon. And it's like being a young kid again, you know. And it's just such a joy in the heart to be able to do this. And you know, I know what it's like to be alone. I know what it's like, you know. And I know the isolation. That's what got me into poetry, was a sense of alienation and isolation, and to have another soul. To be able, I think, was it the writer who wrote Little Prince that said, love is looking into the same direction through two sets of eyes, or was it looking in two different directions through one set of eyes? I can't remember.
S, A, same, G, same difference. some P O some poets want think they need to need I S isolation and S U suffering to write.
You don't have to be a writer to get that.
Say that again.
You don't have to be a writer to get that. Mm. Just be alive. And you'll get a goodly dose of that. That's it. There's so much suffering in the world. Why bother romanticizing it?
Exactly. What? When? I was A at S F San Francisco Art Institute.
You too? I was there. What year were you there?
81, maybe.
Oh, yeah, I was there in 69 or so. 70.
Yes. They F freaked out. B because I have fun. Both the fellow students and the teachers freaked out because Frank was just having too much fun. He enjoyed doing stuff. He would do things and not worry that it was not going to work. Whereas, like, it seemed like most of the people did very little except drink beer and angst. Yeah. Because they were afraid that if they did something, it wouldn't work. Yeah. They were afraid to risk. And, you know, Frank was just, like, doing things. And, oh, well, that didn't work. I'll try this. And it freaked everybody out.
Yeah. It's the joy of, you know, it's kind of like having a dog. And you don't have to have a dog to have a dog. Just have the idea of having a dog. And the dog is like the little kid that you never let grow up. And you keep next to you to remind you that you shouldn't grow up. And you should have that playful spirit. You know, and a dog doesn't worry about making, you know, David's masterpiece when he takes a shit. He just takes a shit. He's not worried about the eternal, you know, repercussions of that. We could learn a lot from shitting dogs.
T-H-A-N. Thank God we are on the internet and public access so we can say whatever we want. Yeah,
I got popped a few things times back in the old days for whale and poetry out in the street. Yeah, this was during the time like Lenny Bruce, man, was he had to. We know his story. We don't have to go over it. But I remember one time.
Even
yeah.
Ever G go T ever got the C O P cops C A L calling ever got the cops call to your R. Oh, have you ever gotten the cops called to one of your readings?
A few times I was wailing out on the street in the village, Washington Square, myself and a bunch of socialists or whatever, we were wailing poetry, and they picked us up in the paddy wagon, drove us around, gave us a you know, verbal lashing. Nothing like what happened to Lenny Bruce, for sure. And then dropped us off, you know, and that sort of thing. And I worked in a cafe where we got some stern warnings about it. I never went to jail except to go to a drunk tank a few times during my early years, but, you know, for that. But no, but that time Lenny Bruce had done.
God, she didn't know him then.
Yeah, she would have given me the frying pan then.
But,
Lenny Bruce really, you know, really did, was the leader on that one.
I
we can all thank Lenny for
M.
that.
I J U I just G got the. The cops called. Is that that's about the Oakland thing? Yeah, he was booked to be a featured reader at a cafe in Oakland, yeah. And then the local weekly paper here, the East Bay Express, did a real nice front page article, yeah. Feature article about Frank and Frank and I were on the cover. I was nude, and that was the cover of the paper, and they had a whole bunch of nude photos inside. So they kind of took a risk, yeah. To do this stuff. It was a good article, and the owner of... And it came out the week that Frank was scheduled to be the reader there. Yeah. And the woman who booked us thought that was cool and put that as the announcement. Check out this week's Express, you know, read all about Frank. Yeah. So the owner of the cafe saw it and freaked and said that she had to get Frank to tell her exactly what he was going to do at his poetry reading.
Which is an impossible task.
Right. Well, you know. So Frank said, I know, I'll never do that. I never do it. I'll never do it. And she said, well, then you're canceled. He said, but I will tell you this. I've always been asked. I'm always asked back.
Trust.
I'm always asked back. That's, you know, which, you know, to us seemed like he was kind of telling her to don't worry about it. But she said, well, you're canceled. And we actually found out we were canceled as we were on our way out the door. You know, I picked up his email and it said, oh my God, look, she said you're canceled. Well, we're going anyway, you know. So we go, and we got there before her, and there were a bunch of people there. And when she walked in the door, she just freaked out, and she started screaming. We had our video camera ready. We had the camera going, you know. What are you doing here? This is my cafe. Get out of here. She didn't even like, you know, did you get my email? I just sent you an email an hour ago telling you were canceled. She didn't, nothing like that. She didn't want to talk about it. The owners didn't want to talk about it. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Well, we said, well, we're not going anywhere. And she said, well, then I'm canceling. The whole series is canceled for tonight. Frank said, great. We'll just do our own reading then.
Yes.
And who's the first on the sign-up list? So we got to the second reading on the sign-up list.
Yeah.
And the second reader, yeah, went a little bit crazy because she's very involved in the poetry world. And she looked across the room and all of her, all of her kind of fellow poets were in the very back of the restaurant really trying to separate themselves from us, that they weren't involved. S-C-U-M, scum. They were scum. Yeah, you're calling them scum now. It was pretty gross, you know. And so she started, you know, directing her poem at them. So they crank up the music in the cafe and call the police. She's like in her 70s, and they're like, the cops come and they're dragging her out of the cafe. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We had the whole thing taped. And Frank said, fine, you know, we'll do it out on the sidewalk. And we all go out on the sidewalk, and he has me go in to announce to the poets in the back, the poetry reading is going to be out on the sidewalk. Well, they're all kind of doing like this, trying to pretend they, like, really don't see me or hear me. Frank says, well, wheel me in there. And the cop is like trailing us. You're not allowed in here. But he lets me wheel Frank to the back. He kind of lets me do it. Yeah, he stands there next to Frank while I spell Frank out, you know. He says, he confronts them, you know. And as he's talking to them, they're all just kind of really saying mealy mouth kind of, oh, I didn't bring any poems. Oh, I didn't come here intending to read. Like this. Obviously, I was all bullshit. And at one point, after Frank had kind of had his say with everybody, the cop said to the poets, are they with you, meaning us? Yeah. And all in unison, no, they're not with us, they're not with us. Like, P-E-T, Peter, with Christ. You know, do you know he? It was, you know. And so that was that. We did the poetry reading out on the sidewalk. The cop actually, the owners didn't want us there. I mean, because there, the newspaper is all over the cafe with our nude picture on the front, and it was just ludicrous, you know. And we're out. It's cold. We're all bundled up. We're out there. The people that came to hear us are sitting out there, standing out there, and the owners, they don't want us there because everybody in the cafe is looking at us and thinking, what are they doing to this poor guy in a wheelchair, you know? And the cop says, you can't be here. And Frank said, is it illegal to be here? He says, well, it's illegal to block the sidewalk. Well, what if we don't block the sidewalk? Is it illegal? Well, you can't sit on their bench. That's illegal. Well, what if we don't sit on their bench? Well, no, I guess it's not illegal.
He's probably pulling at straws, wasn't he?
Yeah, and Frank said, well, why don't you stick around? I'm going to be reading some poems. By that time, the cop is our buddy. The owners are fuming that, and they pull him to the side. They're trying to get him to kick us away, but he couldn't. And so they were really, you know, they were locked in their own cafe for like an hour and a half while we did our reading. And everybody was like streaming out of the cafe to pick up a copy of the paper. You see the whole cafe filled with people reading the article. Pardon?
That's what you call canned heat.
Canned heat?
Canned heat, yeah. Well, you know, I personally don't like open mics. I really don't. It's too bloody incestuous, and there's too much political interplay between the poets themselves. And it's a pain in the ass to have to listen to 25 people boil poetry. It's a goddamn pain in the ass. You know, and I'm not passing judgment whether the poetry is good or not. It's just a pain in the ass. And I have to take this opportunity to say, we in 2003 have it really good because there's some brave souls. Some 35 years ago, Levy in Cleveland, what's his name, D.A. Levy, I'm trying to think, you know, in this Midwest town, really got up and did some poetry that was outrageous and beautiful and powerful and political and beatific. And he said what he wanted to say. And the Cleveland police went nuts on him. They didn't have the humor of a cop maybe in 2003, you know, and didn't have the basis, the background basis of it. It was like, you wail this kind of stuff, and you were a commie. And that was it. And he wound up mysteriously with a bullet in him, you know. And he wasn't the only person. So there have been some very, very brave people through the years that have put their necks out on the line so that we can have our freedom of expression. And we don't, that has nothing even to do with swearing. It really doesn't. That's just a small part, has nothing to do with sex. Very small part, you know, it has everything to do with opening your heart and the spirit of the heart to what you need to put out there without having some, you know, bureaucrat tell you, filter it through, you know, their cranium plantation or what is right and what is wrong. Yeah, that is.
I A L almost H A had A L A W a law in my honor, That's the Berkeley City Council. They were Frank has a public access television show. This will be on there also. And it's like a 2.5-hour show. It's on once a week, but they replay it. So it ends up playing 3 times a week. And it's adult programming. You just say if it's adult and it plays after 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. And so there were people in the city council that decided that they didn't want Frank's show on. And so first they tried to get the nonprofit that runs the cable access to change the rules so it would only Frank's show and another show we sponsor couldn't start until 2 a.m. And once we got wind of that, Frank did a letter to the editor. We got it published all over the local stuff. We got the one of the networks involved. They went out on an AP story. And so when the reporters show up at the next meeting, they say, "Oh, we jumped at it too fast. No, we'll put it back to 10 yeah. p.m." So then the city council said, "Well, let's pass a law. That's the way we'll do it. If we can't get them to do it, we'll pass a law." So they got the city attorney. This is all for Frank. They write Frank's up this law. Frank's law, where basically Frank's show and the show we sponsor would play after midnight. And we were at a lot of city council meetings, got a lot of front page stuff. Frank was writing things. And eventually the ACLU, they did one vote and it passed. And they had to do a second vote. The ACLU showed up and wrote this very good letter about how it was unconstitutional. Mm. Just disappeared. Mm. No one ever brought it up again. There was never a second vote. Just into the ethers.
I had a normal law that passed. When I first came to the West Coast in 67, I worked in a dynamite factory that blew up. It wasn't there anymore. And I was on unemployment. And so I showed up. Took 6 months to go across the country, and I came to the West Coast, and so I wanted to be on unemployment, and I had worked for it, and I showed up at the unemployment bureau, and my hair was long, and she says, "Oh, you got to cut your hair," and I said, "What do you mean I got to cut my hair?" And she says, "You're unpresentable for a job." I said, "Who are you, my grandma?" You know, and they said, "No, you have to do it." And they cut me off. And I went to the American Civil Liberties Union, and they, for a whole year, they fought. They were really good. They fought. This is in San Francisco in the summer of love. They fought for it. At the end of there, they passed it that was definitely prejudiced to hold a person's looks up to whether they can work or not. And I don't know if it's called Norman's Law. I don't know what it's called.
That's close enough. Yeah.
Probably just like Frank's Law. Is that
technically, but it wasn't called Frank's Law.
It's probably the guy, whoever was running the judge was that day. They probably got himself in it. You know, got himself. The law was his.
Yes. You? Have a S.O. a son who is A.L. also S. T-R-A Strange.
The understatement of the year.
I raise them strange.
She said she raises them strange. How? And how and why?
I just wanted to make sure of a couple of things. One, that my son always felt that he could create, because I was an artist and I wanted him to always express himself. And the other important thing to me was that he treat women well, and that he really loved his life. And I guess I did a good job.
He has a sense of magic about him. And I think that's the most important thing a person can have in life is, A, harm nobody, as like the Buddha said, but also to keep that sense of child magic about whatever you do, even if it's collecting tolls out on the highway, to be able to play. To play and not take yourself seriously. Too many people go off a bridge because they take themselves seriously.
And? They are the M.O. most A. B. Absurd. P. People. The ones who take themselves too seriously and jump off a bridge. The ones who take themselves too seriously and jump off a bridge? Yeah. Or just take themselves too seriously, period?
Unfortunately, they don't jump off the bridge. They, right. They run the country.
Right. Right. Her son was E. Extreme Elvis is what?
Guitar player.
Guitar player. Extreme Elvis is guitar player. And C. And was the B. Was the H U S husband? Is that right? He is
no,
he
they were never
connected
married.
Boyfriend
to Anne Marie, but not anymore.
Yeah. Ex boyfriend,
very good friends. So,
yeah. And Anne Marie is the backup singer for Extreme Elvis. Yes,
I just saw them last night.
That's a picture of Frank when he did it. He was Extreme Elvis. I don't know if you can see
yeah,
it there.
We saw it.
Yeah,
he said that. Actually, we just were staying at Emery's house down in Half Moon Bay. It has a goat farm down there, old ranch. It's beautiful back in the woods there. Just gorgeous. And her mom and her father, just beautiful, beautiful people. You could see where she gets her beauty from. Just good people. Yeah. Good people.
He's still living on Anne Marie's parents' property. And
Colin.
Yeah. And even though he's not with Anne Marie, because they split up and they're such good friends. They just wanted to remain friends. And it's special. Their relationship is very special.
I impressed B by her when Frank was Extreme Elvis that night. Anne Marie came over. She was the only one that the the alter ego of Extreme Elvis, told in his band that Frank was going to do the gig that night. And so she came over with him when we did the costume changes and all that stuff. And she was the one, we did a whole cell phones on the street kind of thing. And she came to the car and wheeled Frank into the club. But, yeah, it was really impressive the way she was with Frank and just how present she was with him and really attentive and made sure everything was okay through the whole set. Yeah, yeah. It's almost. It's 20 to 11. How long have we been going? Can you see what the top deck says? Very up.
It's 2 hours 16 minutes.
2 hours 16. Our cable access is 228. Oh. You. Our. B. A. N. Our band tonight. Dr. Oblivious. The wonderful Dr. Oblivious.
Thank you, Dr. O.
Yeah, and Kirsten Rose, the yeah. wonderful Kirsten yeah. Rose.
You sing like yeah. your name, beautiful, yeah, like a blooming yeah. flower.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Who? K. E. Kept fixing all of your gadgets that were falling off all during the reading. And of course, Normal and Charlotte, the wonderful Charlotte.
Thank you guys for having us. It was just a beautiful evening. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Really. Thank you, Mikey. And,
Mikey, yeah. Tech Boy. Yeah.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Thank you, Frank.
Right.
He's a guy.
F U. Fun, P, L, playing with you. Frank is saying it was fun playing with you, accompanying
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's fun. I want to hear what that sounded like when we played it over again. We had some good moments there, man. It was great.
Yeah. One of my F. A. Fantasies that I did not K. No, I had was what doing P playing piano B. A, oh, backing poetry by playing piano. Did you just discover that tonight?
Yeah, is this the first time you did that?
Yes. No, it's the
Frank,
first time you did that.
Is this the first time
you
did that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hey, that's fun, isn't it, man?
Yeah, it's
yeah music
really
and
nice.
Poetry are like inseparable.
Yeah.
I mean, they really flow together. That's why, you know, when I do the CDs, that's how it goes. It's beautiful. It's the Holy Trinity of poetry.
E, A, L, L, really? I, J, just have B, been playing piano just a few years. He started playing it since we've been doing this show because he would have people over playing music and he wanted to do something, so he'd say, "Can I jam with you?" And that's and they seemed to think it was okay, so that kind of encouraged him to keep doing it.
Yeah, yeah. It's I think together poetry and music just open up I call it a holy trinity of poetry, where we were talking about the antennas receiving the poetry and then recreating it with the music. So it's spontaneous. It's never the same. Never the same. It's always different, the poem. And then the third part of the trinity of poetry is in the ear, you know, and the eye, the inner eye and the inner ear and the inner heart of the person who's receiving it. And if it's coming with just the words and the music, it's like the full garden. I hate stuffy poetry.
I was S-T-E-V Steve A-L-L Steve Allen. And he was
Jack Kerouac, right? Right. Yeah. Hello, Steve-O. That is a riot. That's a
That's funny.
Okay, so that's it. And Susie Block's coming up later, playing with Passion, following that. FDA. We'll be playing the dance, the Pantanic dance ritual that Frank and Kirsten and I did on Thursday night at the Sacred Profanities Art Reception. Your player's going to stop. Hit play again. This is Lover.